Hello and welcome to this week's Liverpool Live podcast. I'm Johnny Coop and I will be discussing this week's news stories in Liverpool, plus a roundup of the sports headlines with Jake Cottrell on what's going on in the city this week. First we hear from Joe Anderson after announcing the 10 Shaw Start Children's Centres will remain open for another 2 years. Find out why Jeremy Clarkson has angered the people of Liverpool.
He shouldn't be given the airtime. Does he not realise that a very vibrant, cosmopolitan city...
Shouldn't say it in the first place. As he says, he's got a reputation for putting his foot in it.
There's always two sides, isn't there? So I'm not upset.
Parents and staff react with joy at the news that all 17 of Liverpool's Shaw Start Children's Centres are safe from closure. Council bosses previously unveiled plans to axe 10 of the centres later this year in the wake of the massive government cuts, but Mayor Joe Anderson on Monday announced he had found the £3 million needed to keep the centres running until 2017. Our reporter Luke Holliday was at the meeting and joins me now. So why was this meeting and announcement so important for people in Liverpool?
Well, people in Liverpool have felt the cuts hard, and although Mayor Joe Anderson has kept reminding everyone that he is fighting them, people have been critical of him for some of the areas that he has chosen to cut. And so this announcement to keep open the Sure Start centres was actually a massive relief for many people. I spoke to some people outside St George's Hall before the meeting who have been campaigning to keep the centres open.
It's a city where there's an average of 33% of children living in poverty. In some areas, it's 54% living in poverty. If the proposed structure comes into place, we'll have a disaster on our hands. Children won't be safe, the level of services will be watered down. We work with some of the most vulnerable children and families in the city. If that work goes out of the window, heaven help Liverpool's future.
So what was the atmosphere like outside the hall?
Well, some people had been predicting protests, but the more I spoke to people, the more I realised just how nervous everyone was and how much they actually cared about this issue. A large crowd never really gathered, but you could feel the anticipation amongst people as over 150 people eventually entered the hall. The signs and placards normally associated with these sort of events, they never really materialised, although one did catch my eye, which simply read, "Don't make the children pay."
So how did the meeting go?
Well, obviously the announcement that the centres would be safe for another 2 years was met with relief from everyone in the room, but far from being full of praise for the mayor, the question and answer session actually brought a lot of tough questions for him. He was still being criticised for implementing these cuts, but time and time again he responded by saying that the cuts came from the central coalition government and he could do nothing about them. Here's a clip from the meeting at St George's Hall.
What I say to you is the limited amount of money that we've got, believe you me, the same values that you have, the same principles of fairness that you've got, I have, and I want to protect them.
So the campaigners will claim a success on this one, but what does the future look like?
Well, it is a victory for the people that have long campaigned to keep these centres open. In reality, though, I would think this announcement might have been expected, and we don't have to look too far back in history to find the mayor saving the libraries from closing. The centres have been saved through funds raised by public organisations such as the NHS and housing associations. But the question will surely crop up again in 2 years' time, and the campaigners may well be back on the streets. I spoke to some of them after the meeting to get their reaction.
Well, as a children's centre worker and a parent in the city, I'm absolutely thrilled. We have battled since we got the current government, really, who removed the ring fence. This has been coming up over and over again, and it's nice to get a commitment from a Labour council to protect these services for another 2 years.
We'll be back to square one again. We'll all have to start back where we were 4 years ago and just keep moving forwards.
Go down to the constituency of Tatton, which is George Osborne's constituency. 200,000 people emerging on Tatton would do more than 200,000 people going to Parliament.
Jeremy Clarkson has become the latest celebrity to criticise Liverpool. A number of others have made derisive comments about Scousers in the past, including London Mayor Boris Johnson. Clarkson, who is best known for presenting the worldwide TV hit Top Gear, has been mired in controversy over recent years. BBC chiefs have already warned him he will be sacked if he makes one more offensive remark anywhere at any time. This follows another incident when he was accused of using a racist word in an outtake from the show. Ruby Molyneux has been finding out more about his Scouse swipe.
In his Sunday Times article, he described his recent trip to Liverpool, a place where people earn less, die more quickly, have fewer jobs and live in houses that are worth the square root of sod all. His comments came as the BBC Worldwide began a major four-day event at the Echo Arena, screening British programming, including Top Gear, to TV buyers from across the world. We took the full original Sunday Times article to the people of Liverpool to get their reaction.
He shouldn't be given the airtime. Does he not realise we're a very vibrant, cosmopolitan city and we have capital culture and we've built on it and lived off it?
I actually thought it was a very funny article. There's a little bit of stereotyping in it when he talks about Docker's vests. But hey, we're Scousers, we can laugh at ourselves.
He's there slating everyone, earn less, die more quickly, and he's happy to take money for shows and do Top Gear Live in the Echo Arena in the middle of Liverpool. Shouldn't say it in the first place. As he says, he's got a reputation for putting his foot in it.
Liverpool Mayor Joe Anderson said he will speak to a BBC director about Jeremy Clarkson after the comments he made. The mayor branded the presenter an oaf and a buffoon after his description of his stay, where he claimed a waitress did not know what a kipper was. A report in the Liverpool Echo said the comments were derogatory and said Clarkson slated the city, rounding up angry and mocking responses from Liverpoolians. Clarkson addressed the people of Liverpool in an angry tweet, urging residents to read his original column in the Sunday Times. He said parts of his column had been left out and implied that its meaning had been distorted by the Echo. Do the people of Liverpool agree?
When I first seen it on the Echo website, I thought he was totally out of order, but when you read the full article, you know, it's quite positive what he's saying about Liverpool. He's a sarcastic type of guy anyway, you know what I mean? You've just got to take it with a pinch of salt.
You have to have a Liverpool sense of humour, don't you? But the only thing he's slagging off, really, is the food, isn't it? It's like eating the Dockers wet there.
Sounds a funny. Clashes, isn't there, in the culture, so it's completely different up here than what it is down there.
He's just an idiot in general, isn't he? To be honest with you, I think wherever he goes, he's going to upset people.
Shock, doesn't he?
There's always two sides, isn't there? So I'm not upset, and I'm from, you know, Liverpool. I'm as Scouse as you can get, so it doesn't bother me.
Gets attention, doesn't he? Gets in the media.
Clarkson, who is originally from the north himself, concluded that the north of England is so different from the south that it has become abroad. He pointed out that visitors, like himself, shouldn't expect Liverpool to be the same as London and should adjust their eating habits accordingly.
That was our reporter, Ruby Molyneux, on the streets of Liverpool. Sir Malcolm Rifkin has stepped down as chairman of Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee after criticism over cash for access claims, as shown on Channel 4 Dispatches programme on Monday night. The former Foreign Secretary is also standing down as a Conservative MP. Bethan Tully has more.
Sir Malcolm Rifkin has said he may have made errors of judgement after being secretly recorded, apparently offering his services to a private firm for cash, but denied any wrongdoing. He said he did not want the committee's work to be distracted or affected. Another former Foreign Secretary, Labour's Jack Straw, also featured in the undercover investigation by the Daily Telegraph and Channel 4's Dispatches, which was shown on the channel on Monday night. I spoke to BBC Radio Lancashire politics reporter Chris Ryder, who told me that the two are incredibly well respected and they will most likely overcome this scandal. For Jack Straw and Malcolm Rifkind, do you think it's an abuse of their power to be doing cash for access when they could be earning money other ways?
All the MPs are obviously very, very well paid, and a lot of them do move on to do other things. I mean, so Malcolm Rifkind and Jack Straw are both very senior politicians, well respected, you know, by all the parties. From Jack Straw's point of view, I think he's annoyed about being caught out in what's been a sting. Channel 4 and the Daily Telegraph, in effect, set them up for them to speak their mind, if you like, about whether they should receive lucrative payments to get involved in various businesses. And, of course, all these businesses were fictitious. So I think Jack Straw's main point is that, first of all, he has done nothing wrong. He hasn't done anything illegal. He will be investigated by the parliamentary committee. But he's sort of so well regarded that I think he can probably survive this sort of worrying time. Of course, the irony is that Jack Straw is stepping down as an MP at the end of the general election. From a public point of view, when you actually hear people talking about how much they can earn, it doesn't sort of sit very well with people who, many of whom, are sort of fairly cheesed off with politicians. And yet the irony here is, of course, these two are very, very well respected and have been caught out, if you like.
I mean, you said that like Jack Straw will be able to get over this because he's well respected in the community and things like that. Do you think Malcolm Rifkin will be able to get on with things normally, or will, you know, will this be like a dark cloud always hanging over him now?
Well, the right thing from his party point of view, I mean, they know that he's not done anything illegal, and that's the key point, you know. And because of his background and how well he's done, I think he he'll be able to do the things that actually he was talking about in that room. You know, he will be able to move on and get involved in business or whatever he wants to do. I think the thing to remember is that all MPs, you know, come to an end of their tenure, they get a payoff, so, you know, they're not short of money, if you like. And after that, they can go ahead and do what they want to do. You know, they're not sort of restricted, you know, in a sense, because by then, once they've stepped down as being a politician, they can live the life that they want to do. And I think Malcolm Rifkind, I like Jack Straw as well, respected, so I think he will get over it in a few weeks' time. People will have forgotten, because there'll be something else to talk about, you know, the general election or some other party scandal or whatever. Always seems to happen around general election time. I wonder why that might be.
Both MPs have referred themselves a Parliament standards watchdog and both deny breaching House of Commons rules.
That was our reporter Bethan Tolley speaking to BBC Radio Lancashire politics reporter Chris Ryder. Coming up in the programme, we speak to Professor John Tong after it was announced the Church of England are paying less than the living wage.
There's a duty upon the Church of England to pay higher wages than those that are being offered. You know, Church of England are low, it may not have the wealth it once had, it can still afford to pay workers.
For more on all the latest news, sport, entertainment, views and reviews, bookmark jmu-journalism.org.uk.
According to a new report by mental health charity Beat, it's estimated that eating disorders cost the UK economy £8 billion a year. Liverpool Life reporter Eleanor Finn has more on the story.
The findings highlight inconsistent access to treatment as one of the factors to blame and have been released ahead of Eating Disorder Awareness Week. Referrals within the health service often take too long, as it is believed one in five suffering with an eating disorder can wait up to a year for NHS treatment for the psychological condition. Statistics show that timing is absolutely crucial for treatment, and relapse rate for sufferers are reduced from 63% to 33% for those who seek help early. Eating disorders claim more lives than any other mental illness, and one in five of the most seriously affected will die prematurely from the physical consequences or suicide. Lee Best is the head of Liverpool self-help group Talking Eating Disorders.
There is not really a practice of early intervention. Very often the GP is your gateway to services, and very often the treatment will hinge on whether the GP is understanding and supportive or not. So people are still sent away with diet sheets. So I think the first hurdle really is more robust GP training. I guess you could argue that eating disorders are a really complex psychological condition, and GPs who are fantastic aren't mental health specialists. So in a way, for me, the first hurdle is why not assess people by a mental health specialist in the beginning, you know, in the very, very beginning, so they can assess needs. Particularly with adult services, you're likely to be on a four-month waiting list. As a therapist myself, I can tell you that the time, if somebody rings and they really want help, really they could do with being seen in the following week or two.
That was Lee Bess, the head of the Liverpool self-help group, Talking Eating Disorders. A performance venue in the centre of Liverpool is appealing for funds to help rejuvenate the historic site. The Dome on Renshaw Street is a Grade 2 listed building that needs £45,000 to get the facilities back up to scratch. Manager of the Dome and head of the funding project, Sean Finity, along with his partner Jenny, insists that they will stop at nothing to restore the hidden gem of Liverpool back to its former glory. Sean spoke to our reporter Ben Matthews about the funding.
Well, what it is, we've been renovating it for about 4.5 years now. Basically, what's happened is we've run out of cash to do repairs. But it's absolutely stunning inside, absolutely stunning. But the toilets need bringing up to scratch. The stage needs to be extended. We've got dressing rooms that need to be done. We've also got a few leaks that need to be repaired. And the idea is to bring it back to the way it was when it was first painted, and so it's nice again. It's a hidden gem of the Liverpool City. we've just, unfortunately, we've gone as far as we can financially. We've actually sold everything that we own. We own nothing. We're down to one car between two of us, and we've got, you know, we've got five kids, we've got a family to run. But we haven't done, this is not about money. This is what it's about is, it's about supporting Liverpool music, Liverpool theatre, and the idea is to bring it into a state where it can compete with the other venues in Liverpool. We're not a corporation. We're just a Liverpool couple who have just found this place and want to bring it back to what it should be.
That was Sean Finity, manager of the Dome. Church of England has been accused of hypocrisy for demanding a minimum living wage of £7.85, despite offering potential staff as little as £6.50 an hour. Hannah Kane has more on the story.
The House of Bishops sent out a letter last week to all church members saying they back the living wage, which ensures people live decently. I spoke to political professor at Liverpool University, John Tong, who believes the Church of England is being hypocritical.
Well, it's a huge embarrassment for the Church of England. They issued a report last week which was criticised, particularly on the Conservative side of things, for being too left-wing, where they criticised the coalition government for mistreatment or not caring enough about workers. And then it turns out that their own organisation is actually paying some workers below the living wage. So it's a huge own goal for the Church of England, and one that they're going to struggle to recover from in credibility terms.
Do you think with the Church of England recently speaking about the coalition government and how they're treating people, do you think that it sort of undermines everything they've been saying about the government?
Yeah, it does. They're criticising the government for practices that they're engaging in themselves. I mean, there's no evidence that government employees, at least, are paid less than the living wage. The problem appears to lie within the Church of England. They're the ones who are underpaying their workers in quite a blatant manner. I mean, they're actually advertising for workers at £6.50 an hour. Given that the Church of England tried to take the moral high ground last week about giving workers a better deal and treating them fairly, for them to be presiding over such practices, I think, you know, really does put them in a difficult position. And I think that Archbishop Justin Welby will be have his head in his hands today. So the Church of England's got to put its own affairs in order before it goes issuing criticism of other organisations, in particular at the government. Only it's losing its authority every time it makes utterances, which are then followed by embarrassment over how the Church of England is acting.
The House of Bishop said that the living wage represents the principles that lives cannot adopt infinitely in response to the market prices. Do you think £6.50 is a livable wage for people?
I don't think £6.50 is a livable wage for most people. The strong pressure, for example, from the trade unions to have a much higher wage. The fact is, the minimum wage has become something of a floor, and the living wage, you know, is an attempt to try and get wages up slightly. I think, you know, I would personally rather see a lowest wage of £10 per hour, but you'd have other organisations, you'd have businesses complaining about that, arguing that it costs jobs. But let's face it, you know, again, although you don't join the Church of England or work for them to get rich, you're going to be struggling if you're on £6.50 an hour.
TUC have actually come out stating that it's at one of its worst states, the national living wage, and people are being severely underpaid. How do you think these... Do you have any idea how you think maybe these problems can be resolved?
Well, you'd have to raise the minimum wage or the living wage a lot higher. No businesses have gone bankrupt because of the minimum wage. We can afford to pay it, and I think we should pay a higher lowest wage. That way, you know, people will come out of the poverty trap that they're in on those wages. You've got to remember that an awful lot of people are, quite rightly, being told, don't stay on benefits, you've got to find work. But a lot of people are reluctant to take work when they're being paid so lowly. You know, it's hardly worthwhile them going to work on wages like that. So for the Church of England to even be paying below it, you know, is quite stunning.
The Church of England told me that the pastoral letter from the House of Bishops encouraged churches to implement the living wage, and that each of their parishes and cathedrals is a separate legal entity with trustees and has to act in light of its own circumstances. Meanwhile, the Trade Union Congress research found that one in five jobs pay less than £9.15 an hour if you live in London and £7.85 elsewhere. TUC Chief of the North West, Lynn Collins, says that all employers who can should pay the living wage.
You can see across the North West as a whole, two in every five jobs are less than that. But there's some pockets in constituencies throughout the North West where the figure is almost half. But what we're calling for is employers who can afford to pay more to pay the living wage. Now, the difference between the minimum, statutory minimum, and the living wage is the living wage is a real life calculation. It's based on the actual costs of living and it's reviewed and updated every year. And that's the basic people need to get by. And our argument is that if people go out and do a full week's work, they should be able to earn enough to get by. And they shouldn't have to be subsidised by taxpayers paying benefits to people who are at work when employers should be paying them the right rate for the job.
Bar staff and shop assistants are the most likely victims of low pay. Lynn Collins went on to tell us about what she thought about the living wage.
Well, in the long term, I can't see our economy in the Northwest improving if we don't put spending power back into people's pockets. We also see a massive rise of in-work poverty. So more and more we're hearing from food banks that not only is it people on benefits who are going to use food banks, it's people who are actually in work and paid low rates of pay.
The coalition government say that they are committed to reducing taxes for the lowest paid and increasing employment.
That was our reporter Hannah Kane speaking to Professor John Tong and TUC leader Lynn Collins.
For more on all the latest news, sport, entertainment, views and reviews, follow us on Twitter at JMU Journalism and come back often.
Now let's find out the latest sport news with our reporter, Jake Cottrell.
Both Everton and Liverpool are in Europa League action this Thursday night. Liverpool returned to the Olympic Stadium in Istanbul, where they won the Champions League in 2005. This time they faced Besiktas, taking a slender 1-0 lead into the second leg, with kick-off at 6 p.m. Everton will be confident of progressing to the next round of the competition, without too many problems. They face BSC Young Boys at Goodison Park, having impressively won the away leg 4-1. Kick-off is at 8 p.m. Tranmere Rovers were plunged further into relegation trouble as they threw away a 2-goal lead to lose 3-2 to Portsmouth at Fretton Park on Tuesday night. At 2-0 up with just 15 minutes remaining, Rovers appeared to be well on their way to a priceless victory, but three late Pompey goals broke visiting hearts, meaning Tranmere are now just 3 points off the League Two relegation zone. The Football Association hope to introduce new rules on head injuries in amateur football by March, after a campaign by the family of Jeff Astle. Former West Bromwich Albion, Notts County and England striker Astle died in 2002, aged 59, from a brain condition which is normally linked to boxing. The Premier League introduced new rules on how to deal with head injuries from the start of this season, and the amateur game is set to follow suit. A player suffering a head injury must now leave the pitch, and the club doctor must decide if they are able to play on, where previously it had been up to the management team and the player himself. It's been announced that Liverpool boxer Rocky Fielding will return to action on March the 7th following a hand injury. The undefeated super middleweight will box on the bill of the Hull Arena following his total knockout victory over Noah Gonzalez Alcoba last July. Fielding could also be set for a British title showdown with fellow Scouser Paul Smith this year. Liverpool Basketball Club's winning run was brought to a halt after a nervy start cost them dear in the National Shield final on Monday. They were beaten 68-59 by Newcastle in what proved to be a bitterly disappointing day for Liverpool's senior men's team and their fans. And work has begun on a new £20 million football-themed hotel, which includes a museum with unseen memorabilia of Liverpool's former manager Bill Shankly. The 83-bedroom Shankly Hotel in the former Liverpool City Council building in Victoria Street will display 70 pieces from his family's collection. It is expected to be completed in August, creating more than 200 jobs. I'm Jake Cottrell, and that's your sports roundup for the week.
The ultimate feel-good musical Mamma Mia is at the Empire Theatre until mid-March. Entertainment reporter Bethan Tolley went along to meet Sarah Poyser, who is playing Donna in the musical, and I Do Anything star Neve Perry, who is playing the daughter Sophie.
What is it about Mamma Mia that makes it a success?
I think the beauty of Mamma Mia is that it is a show for everybody. It's a show for the whole family. We've had tiny little five-year-olds in the front row, and we've had some very lovely 85-year-olds in the front row, and everyone enjoys it in their own way. I think the music is timeless. I think that's the beauty of it all, really, is it does appeal to everybody. It's a feel-good show, but it has a lot of truth behind it.
I feel like Mamma Mia is a bit like Shakespeare, in that Shakespeare deals with clear human emotions, jealousy, love, friendship, romance, fear, vulnerability, and that's why Shakespeare is timeless. It's about the heart of it, the heart of it. Everybody relates to it. Young friendship, old friendship, lost love, found love. And like you say, add on top of that the music of ABBA. And I think that's why 54 million people have seen the show. I just think that blows my mind a little bit. Winner Takes It All was voted like ABBA's best song, I think. And I get the privilege of singing that every night, which is amazing. But I love Waterloo. You know, it won the Eurovision Song Contest for a reason. And it's the last number we do, and it's just brilliant. So, yeah, it does change night, but I never get tired of singing these songs.
So what will you be expecting from a Liverpool audience?
I'd say so far it's possibly the best audience I've ever performed in front of. They've been with us from the very beginning. They're a bit crazy, but we love it. It's their, you know, we would much rather have everyone up dancing and singing along than we would to not really know if they're there. So it's been pretty incredible. I think they're loving it so far.
So what is it like starring alongside your husband?
It's great. It's really good. I've got my best friend with me, and he supports me on stage and off. I couldn't wish for anything better, if I'm honest. We have to make sure we make friends every night if we ever have any rows, because we have to get married every night. So it's quite a good romance checker. We keeps the relationship friendly and feisty, which I love.
So how does it compare to previous roles that you've had in TV and film?
Well, I mean, we've both done this show on and off over the years, but I think it's the most natural part I've played. I've played a lot of weirdos. I played Joanna in Sweeney Todd, who was a Sondheim character who's always a little bit abstract. I've played a 10-year-old boy before, so that's obviously quite far from Sophie. And I played a mother and a wife before I played this in The Beautiful Game in London, which is far from Niamh, never mind far from Sophie. So I think it's kind of a one of a kind in my CV, and I think that's why I always come back to it, because I do feel that there's a lot about Sophie's character that I can relate to.
So what about Sophie in particular do you relate to?
I think she's quite feisty. Me and Sarah were chatting about this earlier, actually. Donna is quite a fiery, feisty character, and I think that she's her mother's daughter, and she's quite like her in a lot of ways. She's strong, but she is only 20, so she has a naive quality to her as well.
So apart from Mamma Mia, what are the favourite roles that you've performed on stage?
Quite a fan of the old classics. I've done quite a lot of Shakespeare, that's where my first love is, really. But this is definitely up in the top three. I mean, I think it's life-changing, this role for me in this tour. So yeah, I'd say Donna is definitely up there. Great thing about our job is that, you know, there's wonderful roles that we've played and wonderful roles that hopefully that will come in the future.
That was our entertainment editor, Bethan Tolley, speaking to the cast of Mamma Mia. That's all from Liverpool Live Podcast this week. A special thanks to this week's editor, Camelia Nurani. I'm Johnny Coop. Thanks very much for listening.
This has been the Liverpool Live Podcast, brought to you by the journalism students at the Redmond's News Centre. More next week.